This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2, streaming online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The 11th annual Roger Ebert's Film Festival opens today at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. And our guest this afternoon is one of the filmmakers whose work will be featured. Artist, designer, writer, director, and producer Nina Paley joins me to talk about her work and her critically acclaimed award-winning animated film, Sita Sings the Blues. Roger Ebert says of Paley's accomplishment, "To get any film made is a miracle. To conceive of a film like this is a greater miracle." Nina Paley's film was inspired by an ancient Hindu epic, the Ramayana, which in part tells the story of the beautiful, good, and true Sita, whose husband Rama wrongly accuses her of adultery. The film is also autobiographical. Nina's husband Dave takes what he says will be a temporary job in India. Nina, by herself in New York City, is terribly alone. Then, after visiting him in India, she returns home to find a message from him in her email in the inbox. It says, "Don't come back. Love, Dave." Sita Sings the Blues cuts back and forth between the two stories. The styles of animation change, but the tears and the blues are constant. Paley has used songs recorded by American jazz singer Annette Hanshaw from the 1920s to conjure the depth of heartbreak felt by Sita and Nina.
A lonely woman waiting on a weary shore. I'm just a woman, but only human, one you should be sorry for. Got up this morning, along about dawn, without a warning, I found he was gone. Why should he do it? How could he do it? He never done it before. Am I blue? Am I blue? Ain't these tears in these eyes telling you? Am I blue? You'd be too.
Am I blue? Sita Sings the Blues will be screened Saturday afternoon at 2:30. But you can see the film online whenever you'd like. Visit Nina Paley's website, www.ninapaley.com. Like Roger Ebert, Nina Paley grew up in Urbana. She is the daughter of Gene and Hiram Paley. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join our conversation with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Nina, welcome. It's so wonderful to have you here.
It's great to be back in Urbana with this strange new campus.
Do you get a chance to come back very often?
I don't come back that often. I think the last time I was here was 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 2004.
A lot of changes since then.
Amazing, yes. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of changes the last time I came, but it just keeps going.
Yeah. So how was the invitation extended to you from the festival?
Well, my parents,
yes,
I should say first that my mom, Jean, is the festival relations manager of Sita Sings the Blues and is, of course, incredibly smart and brilliant and used to be an administrator of the math department. And she's the spreadsheet master. So fortunately for me, she retired recently. And when I asked her to help, like, track the film and send out screeners and things like that, she was willing to do it. She's like this, I could not imagine any person or institution being better at this than my mom. So it was her business to figure out who to send the screener to get into festivals, particularly this one, which I really, really wanted to get into, being from Urbana. And unfortunately, she's not here right now, but she knows all the details on who they found and who they sent it to. And eventually, Roger actually watched it.
Yeah, he writes about it in the catalog, the experience of having the DVD, and he thought, oh, yeah, I'll get around to it. And somebody from town, actually, or somebody he worked with in the past, said, you got to see this. And so he did.
Community nudging.
That's right.
I'm very grateful to the community.
Well, your mom is a great fan, of course, of your work, right? But I met her several years ago, and I started talking with her, and I said, well, you're Nina Paley's mom? She said, yes, I am. And I said, well, I love the Hots.
Oh, wow.
So it's been a while since that strip's been in the paper, but it was a good strip.
Oh, well, thanks. That was written by Stephen Hirsch.
And you did the...
I did the drawings, yeah. And I actually, I retired from that while I was getting interested in working on Sita Sings the Blues. Mm. So that void was filled by the film.
I find this amazing film difficult to describe. I think I gave listeners just a tiny taste of it. It is so beautiful. It is so amazing. How do you describe it?
All I say is it's animated, it's musical, it's personal, and it's based on the Ramayana. Mm-hmm. And it really is difficult to describe other than that. It does switch from style to style. When I was working on the film, it was so difficult to describe that it was actually easier to make the film than, for example, write grant proposals for the film. I mean, I did write grant proposals for it, and then they were turned down, except for one. They were turned down with, like, this, you know, this will never work. So, it's unconventional.
There are bright colors, and then there are subdued, almost grayish colors. You go back and forth between the two. There are many textures. The narrators come in the shape of shadow puppets. How did you begin to conceive Sita Sings the Blues?
It started with the songs of Annette Hanshaw, which mm-hmm. I heard shortly after my husband dumped me by email. And I heard in the songs the same story that was in the Ramayana and the same sort of heartbreak that I felt I was going through myself. And even just Am I Blue, which you were just playing, it's like, that is so Sita. She even says she's waiting on a weary shore. And when Sita was exiled from Ayodhya, she's left on the banks of the river.
Yeah.
So the songs were just perfect. And... The style that I used for the songs sort of appeared while I was in Trivandrum in Kerala in 2002. I didn't really know what I was going to do with those drawings, but I just started making them, and I just started drawing in that particular style. I can't really explain why. But the other styles in the film are all derived from existing historical styles of art that are associated with the Ramayana. From South and Southeast Asia. So the shadow puppets come from South and Southeast Asia, from Bali and Cambodia and Thailand and Malaysia, where the Ramayana has been performed for hundreds and if not thousands of years with shadow puppets. And there's these collages behind the shadow puppets, which are made from little bits of cheaply printed devotional cards. Mm-hmm. And there's my fake Mughal miniature painting style, which are based on Mughal miniature paintings. And that era in India, the rulers were Muslim, but they too loved the Ramayana. So there was a lot of Ramayana art commissioned by Muslim rulers.
Yeah. Now, Americans, I'm guessing most of us don't know the story at all. But I understand that Rama is a hero in the epic tale, but in the story, Sita Sings the Blues, he's not a hero at all.
Well, he killed all those demons. He killed demons and did his duty, and that's why he's a hero. And he still does that in Sita Sings the Blues, but of course, my film focuses primarily on his relationship with Sita from a heartbroken Sita's point of view.
Yeah.
And this is very controversial, of course. There are billions of interpretations of the Ramayana. You will hear people say that their relationship was perfect. And I, of course, read many versions of the story, and it didn't strike me that way. But, you know, the debate rages on. So not everyone interprets it this particular way, although many people do.
Is that why the shadow puppets are actually, they discuss what's going on in the story, and they're saying, well, then this happened. No, 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 something else happened.
Right. And the big question is why Rama rejects Sita. That's the great unanswered question. And that, I think, is the beauty of the story, that it sort of asks more questions than it answers. Rama is, over and over again, in the Valmiki Ramayana, Valmiki goes out of his way to say Rama is the perfect man. He's always wise. He's always just. And then he does these things that just devastate Sita. So what's going on here? He's perfect and he's doing this stuff that we would say is not perfect. So what's happening? Mm. And it doesn't answer those questions. It just tells the story.
Yeah. Well, the Sita of Sita Sings the Blues is one voluptuous woman. She's reminiscent of Betty Boop, only, I would say, with a lot more curves. tell us how she began to take shape in your imagination.
Well, from the texts mostly, over and over again, she's described as the most beautiful woman in the world, the perfect woman, the ideal woman. And thinking about what is an ideal woman physically, like the platonic ideal of a woman, that's what I was trying to put in that particular design of Sita. Now, I use several different designs for Sita throughout the film. There's also the much more Mughal miniature painting influenced one where she's not voluptuous at all, right. And her eyes are always down and she's always, you know, sort of covering up her hair and just extremely modest. But that the one that I used for the singing, it was like, well, how ideal could an ideal woman be? What exactly are the physical traits of a man and a woman? Because Rama's design complements Sita's design. I mean, I made Rama's arms absurdly broad, and he has these enormous biceps, and he's like an inverted triangle, and Sita's an hourglass. And these are like, you know, if you sort of take what makes men look like men and what makes women look like women and just exaggerate it, I tried to stay just on this side of recognizability. If I'd abstracted it anymore, they would have just been like circles and triangles.
Yeah.
But that's what I was trying to do.
Well, she's soft and round, and he's kind of chiseled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know which one's the man, and you know which
you
one's
sure
the
do.
Woman.
You sure do. Well, what was your introduction to this epic, Ramayana?
Well, I was living in Trivandrum, India, and I had followed my then husband there. He mm-hmm. was working at an animation studio. There was a small group of Americans working there, training the animators there, and they were circulating among themselves Indian books, Indian comic books. And the first Ramayana that I came across was the comic book version, the Amarchitra Katha comic book version, along with many other, I mean, I read many, many comic books when I was there. They're called mythologicals. But it was this one about Sita that really hooked me. And it was, I think the title of the book was Sons of Rama. And that was the part of the story where Sita is rejected by Rama for a final time. And she calls on Mother Earth to take her back into her womb. And this was given maybe one or two panels of the entire comic book. But it seemed like such a significant story.
Mm-hmm.
That I, you know, started asking my friends there, my Indian friends, like, did this happen? Is this really part of the story? What's going on here? And they said, oh, yes. And so I started looking for more prose versions and bought what English prose versions I could at the local bookstore. And I was in the middle of that, just trying to understand the story, when I went to New York on a business trip. And then my now ex dumped me by email. And that sort of launched me on this adventure, I guess.
Boy, talk about a silver lining, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm actually grateful for the whole experience now. I wasn't at the time.
Oh,
I was like,
how
could this have happened to me? Oh, boo-hoo-hoo. But now that I got a film out of it, and, you know, it was very therapeutic. And so all of those emotions have worked their way through.
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, as the story moves back and forth from India, from India, then we're in San Francisco, then we're in India, then we're in New York, I think.
Yeah.
This is a film you'll want to watch more than once. because it's just, there's so many things to take note of. And the first time through, you're just, it's just, you're awash in it. But anyway, from the story, as it moves back from the U.S. to India, we go from bright colors in India to the subdued colors, and the lines that depict you and your ex are all squiggly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that sort of sums up where you were.
Angstovision.
Yeah, angstovision. Very good. So I'm wondering, as you ultimately, did Sita sustain you through this period? You didn't have any idea. I wouldn't think that ultimately you'd have this beautiful film.
Yeah, no, the story definitely, I was clinging to it because I felt like I wasn't alone. You know, when you go through something like this, it's so confusing and devastating. And Sita herself, the character of Sita herself, says at one point, "I must have committed a terrible sin in a previous life to deserve such suffering." So even she doesn't, even she feels completely alone. That's just how we feel. So coming across this epic from thousands of years ago, from the other side of the planet, it really comforted me because it showed that this is part of being a human being. This is something that so many people go through. I'm not alone. I feel like I'm alone, but I'm really not. This is part of being human.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Nina Paley is our guest this afternoon. She's an artist, designer, writer, director, producer. She's with us this afternoon to talk about her work and her critically acclaimed award-winning animated film, Sita Sings the Blues, which is featured in the 11th annual Roger Ebert's Film Festival, which opens today at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. Roger Ebert says of this film, "To get any film made is a miracle. To conceive of a film like this is a greater miracle." Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, now, you have this film. You're finished with it. It's complete. How do you get it out into the world? Mom helped, but you know, how do you? There's also, you know, Roger Ebert's talking about miracles. That's also a miracle to make something and then to get it out there so people can see it.
Right, that is the big issue for filmmakers. Every film festival discusses distribution, the issue of distribution. Right now, there are more films made than ever before. By an enormous factor, and that's because the technology to make films is now in the hands of commoners, riffraff like me. It used to be just far too expensive and far too rarefied, and the whole distribution system for films, it's this sort of outdated model that's based on a very, very limited supply of films. So there's more films now than the conventional distribution system can handle. This is all stuff that I've learned in the past year and a half. When I started, I thought, because I knew nothing, and also because even if I did know something, the world is changing so quickly, it doesn't really help. But I thought, I'll just get a conventional distributor. And pretty much right when the film was starting to hit film festivals, all of the independent distributors were going bankrupt or being absorbed in their parent companies or because they weren't really independent to begin with. And suddenly there was no money. There had been lots of money in independent films a couple years earlier, and suddenly there was none. So this is like a really long story. I went on quite an adventure, and I can say more about that. But what I realized toward the end was that actually, audiences now can distribute films themselves, and that distributors are more and more, unfortunately, becoming a barrier between audiences and filmmakers rather than a conduit. And that's because of the internet. And so rather than fight it, I embraced it. And I basically took my film straight to the audience and said, "Audience, this belongs to you. You distribute it." And they have been. And it's amazing, and it's wonderful, and this is probably the way of the future.
Very interesting. We've got a listener who'd like to talk with us. So, Nina, want to put your headphones on there, and you can hear the caller. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon is Nina Paley. Let's go and take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Thank you. Actually, I was a fan back when I remember fondly your strip in the DI.
Joyride?
You know, back in the 1970s when you were an undergraduate and had a comic strip.
Yeah, that was actually the late 80s. I think
late 80s. Yeah. I guess I've been around too long.
You confused me with someone better.
Yeah. Well, anyway, what I was calling about is I saw something that you were opposed to intellectual property law, and I guess, you know, the idea of copyright. And while I certainly don't like Disney's idea about copyright where it goes in perpetuity and there, you know, things would never pass into public domain, I'm wondering how you can make money off of your work if you know, you don't have any legal control over it.
Okay, that's a great question. I'm going to take off the headphones now. It turns out that having the film circulating freely increases the value of the film and increases demand for purchasable tokens of the film. So the more people are sharing the film freely, the more demand there is for DVDs, purchasable DVDs, the more demand there is for T-shirts, the more demand there is for seeing it in the theater. We've actually made more 35mm prints since the film was available online for free than before. Then the question, I think the anxiety people have is, well, but anybody can sell this. Anybody can be making money off of it. And it's true. Anybody can sell a DVD of Sita Sings the Blues, as long as they pay the music licensors, which is a whole other story. You know, anybody can broadcast it. It is free to do that. But it turns out that the audience actually wants to support the artist. So if the artist is making DVDs and selling DVDs and selling T-shirts, that's a selling point. They actually want to get the things from me, and they want to get my signature on them. And that's how I make money. There's also, if you go to questioncopyright.org, you can see something there called the Creator Endorsed Mark, which is an alternative to copyright. Copyright, I should say, this is going to sound more radical than it is, but copyright is a kind of censorship. Copyright is, it's funny that it uses the word right. It really means copy restriction. So copyright, all copyright is a government-granted monopoly that gives one entity, one party, the right to sue, or because the laws have changed, actually imprison others for copying the work. Now, in the age of the internet, that really is censorship, because every time you look at something on the internet, your browser is making a copy of it. And, you know, because of digital technology now, everybody has the power to make perfect copies of things. This was not possible when copyright was invented. It was invented in the age of printing presses. They were extremely expensive. Although, to go back a bit, copyright actually originated as a form of censorship. It was the British Crown actually outsourced censorship to the Board of Stationers. You can read about the history of copyright at questioncopyright.org as well. It has a sort of surprising history. We've always been told it's for artists, it helps creators, this is for creators. It's always been for distributors, actually. Copyright was invented by and for distributors, always. There's always a few at the very, 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 very top of the system, a few creators who make tons and tons of money. They believe it's because of copyright. I actually think they could make tons and tons of money without copyright. But there's like a few stars that defend copyright. And then there's, you know, 99% of working artists who, whether or not they believe in copyright, most of their money is not coming from royalties. And that's something that I looked at when I was going through all of this, because I've been a professional artist since I was 18 years old. What is that? That's 20-some years now. And a lot of all my work, I did copyright. And I worked, you know, in syndicated comics. I've done, you know, I've been an illustrator for ad agencies. And everything's been copyrighted. And I looked at that and was like, well, how much have I really made from royalties? And have I enforced these royalties? Or has it always been a distributor that's done it? And I mean, this is like a very, very long conversation, and I'm writing more and more about it. But I looked at my history and was like, actually, no. I've made, if I look at where my money's come from, almost none of it has been from royalties. And I actually benefit more when people can freely share my work. So back to my old comic strips. I am actually looking for a volunteer. If anyone out there has a high-quality scanner and some Photoshop skills and some time, I want to rescan all of my old Nina's Adventures comics and my old Fluff comics and release them in high quality with a Creative Commons share-alike license, because I realized that those comics, they don't have any value if people can't see them. The value comes from the audience. So if those have a share-alike license and the audience is free to share them, including printing them, the value will increase. And then I can sell originals for far more money. And I can sign prints for far more money. It's just like my value as an artist increases, the value of the original increases, and people are sharing it. It's like win-win all the way around.
Yeah. Now, I have the festival screener DVD copy of Sita Sings the Blues. And this, we have a copyright here, 2008, by Nina Paley Productions, LLC. So it was at some point you came to this insight after making the film. And was it because distributors had essentially dried up and turned to dust, as you said, because of the economic situation?
Not really. I mean, there were many factors that went into that decision. One of them was that, the most money distributors were offering. I was actually concerned with how many people would see the film. And distributors were like, we will help people see the film. But then on the festival circuit, I talked to all these filmmakers that had these supposedly desirable commercial distributors, and people were not seeing their film. Many filmmakers that I met were eager for pirates to start pirating their films so that people could actually see it, because the distributors were so behind the times in terms of actually allowing the film to reach people. So if it gets to a point where filmmakers are hoping that their films are pirated, that really makes you question just how much benefit is it to have a regular commercial distributor. Now, they do pay advances. So it's true that if I got a distributor, I could have had $10,000 or $20,000 up front, which I don't have releasing the film for free. On the other hand, far fewer people would be able to see it. Distributors will disagree with me on this. Yeah. And I should add that the film does have distributors now. Like, it has theatrical distributors because I should now go into this thing that you printed out, understanding free content. The film itself is free. The content of the film is free. And if you can make a digital copy of it for free, go for it. But there are many containers of the film. There are many forms of the film that are simply not free and can't be free. And that includes 35mm film prints, which are extremely expensive. We're not at the point where a cinema can download a 35mm film print off the internet. You get a 35mm, it's a very expensive process. They cost a lot to make. They cost a lot to ship. Those you don't get for free. So there are actually two different theatrical distributors that are distributing it in the east and west of the United States. And they are, you know, handling the money and handling the shipping, and theaters are booking it through them. And that's another way that people are making money. Even though the film is free online, that's actually increased the demand for the film in cinemas. So these distributors are doing fine. It's all fairly new, but they've made several bookings without having to spend any money on advertising.
Yeah, I'd love to see it in a 35mm format, because it's so beautiful. I mean, if it looks as good as it does in your DVD player, imagine what it looks like on the screen of the Virginia Theater.
And that's the kind of thinking that that's helping this. And there's nothing better to sell the film than the film. You know, like, if you can see it, how will you know if you want to see it in the cinema? Well, you can watch it online in a little box, or you can download it if you have the time. But all of these, you know, copying the films actually takes a lot of work on the part of the audience. And many audience members don't want to do that much work. They'll watch it streaming. That doesn't take too much work. But they see it, like, in a tiny little box, and then they want to see a nicer version.
Well, you know, in public radio, we've been doing this for a while now. We put it out there. And then later we say, could you give us some money for the job we've done? And also, we're very excited about getting our podcasts out there. Mm-hmm. And we have a terrific website, and you can download, and presumably you can do whatever you want with material that's there, which is another interesting point. On your website, this is the SitaSingsTheBlues.com website, you write, Dear Audience, I hereby give Sita Sings the Blues to you. You don't need my permission to copy, share, publish, archive, show, sell, broadcast, or remix. That's interesting. Why? I think if I made this, I had made this film, I would say, don't mess with it.
I know. That's what we usually do. The thing is that because the film is free, because everyone knows where it came from, I am under no risk of people thinking that other people's remixes are mine. If the film were locked up, if everyone didn't have access to the original, then it might confuse people when people did remixes. But everyone knows now how to get the film as I made it. So if somebody recuts it and does stuff with it, that's not going to be confused with my film. I just want people to know this is the film that I made. You know, this is the original. Now you do whatever you want with it. If you change it, put your name on it as well. Part of the Creative Commons share-alike license is it's an attribution license. So it does need to be attributed to me. If people make changes to it, they need to attribute those changes to themselves. So if people recut the film, which no one I'm aware of has done yet, but if they do, it's like, you know, this is the Sam Smith edit.
Yeah. Now, there is a wrinkle with Sita Sings the Blues, and that's the music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a long story, but maybe you'd make it short for us.
Yes. It's the old music. A lot of the music is new and commissioned by people specifically for the film. But the old songs, the Annette Hanshaw songs from the mid-1920s, it turns out that Annette Hanshaw's voice is in the public domain. So the copyright on her recordings has expired. It's public domain everywhere in the world except New York State. So the film may end up being banned in New York State. We're not sure yet. We're just going ahead. It's up to whoever asserts themselves as the owner of these recordings. If they want it to be banned in New York State, I'm happy to comply with that because I'm going to make a big fuss because what that means is
just
that...
Just spell her name correctly.
Yeah, just spell my name correctly. Banned in New York. And then, of course, sales will just go through the roof, right? If it's banned
What's all
in
this
New York.
About?
I know. New Yorkers will really want it then. But the compositions that underlie the recordings, those are not out of copyright. All of this stuff was supposed to be public domain in the 1980s. Like the caller said, you know, copyright, he's aware that copyright terms have just been extended and extended and extended. Regardless of whether you're pro-copyright or anti-copyright or whatever, most people agree that copyright terms are far, far, far too long. So a result of these copyright extensions is they never enter the public domain, and they may never enter the public domain, which means that they're controlled by a handful of corporations who are under no obligation to grant permission to use them, who can charge whatever they want. And in the case of Sita Sings the Blues, they wanted more money than it cost to make the entire film. And there was simply no way I was going to raise that. Again, this is an old model. Financial model for charging for rights is based on when only very, very rich people could make films. So, yeah, you know, 60 years ago, if your song ended up in a film, there was some very wealthy studio that was, you know, using it. And of course, they should pay lots of money to you because they had millions of dollars. Nowadays, riffraff are making films and we're poor. And we don't have millions of dollars. So according to the law, we are not supposed to show I wasn't supposed to show anyone the film. I was actually breaking the law by showing people the film. And I could have faced up to 5 years in jail for that. And I did it anyway. Now I have borrowed $50,000. I hired a rights clearance house, which negotiated the amount down, but with what's called a step deal. So what that step deal means is that if I sell more than 5,000 DVDs, I have to pay more. If the film makes more than $1 million in box office, I have to pay all that money over again. So, you know, there's actually a disincentive for me to sell more than 5,000
DVDs. Right, that's why you've got
DVDs.
A limited edition.
Yes, I'm making – the artist's edition of Sita Sings the Blues is limited to 4,999.
Director's cut. Kind of.
Yeah. Actually, the content of the DVD is exactly the same. You can get this content for free online. What I'm selling is the packaging. People actually want the packaging, and it's a pre-downloaded DVD. So it's also like the service. Like, yes, you can spend, you know, 4 hours downloading the thing and then burning it and hoping it comes out right. Or you can buy this nice package that has the stuff already on the DVD and it's silk screened. And if you get the expensive version, it's signed by me. But we're going to – questioncopyright.org is going to be selling a cheaper version, a consumer version for like $20.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon is Nina Paley. She's a filmmaker. She's an animator. She's an artist. She's a writer, director, producer, and I think soon to be a lawyer.
No, not a lawyer, but no. Okay. I'm happy to talk to lawyers.
Okay. Anyway, her film, Sita Sings the Blues, is being featured in the 11th annual Roger Ebert's Film Festival, which opens today at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. Well, we've got a couple of more listeners wanting to talk with you, Nina, so let's go and take another call. And we're going to go next to a cell phone, a listener on a cell phone, on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello. I'm very glad to hear you on this show. I just wanted to call in and say that I just finished sending a tweet, twittering a message about your appearance here on AM 580. I'm twittering Ebertfest for the online publication SmilePolitely.com, and of course, all of us who write for Smile Politely do exactly what you've been talking about, which is we write for free, and it's like so many other things with the arts these days, they are done for free. So I'm very impressed with your way of dealing with copyright. I presume you know about a lawyer. You were just talking about lawyers, Lawrence Lessig, I believe, who deals with copyright issues and creativity.
Yes, and I think Lessig started the Creative Commons, which is the type of license that I released Sita Sings the Blues under. I chose a Creative Commons share-alike license, which means everybody's free to share it, and there's no commercial restrictions or anything like that. The only rule is that if you make a derivative work, you must release the derivative work under the same license. So you cannot take a derivative work and then – you cannot make a derivative of it and then copyright that. You have to free that as well. And yay, Smile Politely.
Smile Politely. It's great. I guess I just have one more comment to say is that about a year ago I was in New York and I ran into the filmmaker John Waters, and I had used a number of clips from his films for some YouTube movies that I'd made. I'd not just shown the clips. They were incorporated into the films that I had made. So I talked to him and said, you know, I hope you don't sue me. He said, well, I won't sue you. But the distributor, New Line, might. So mm-hmm. I think it's, as you say, it's the distributors who are more concerned with fair use of works of art than the creators themselves. Anyway, congratulations on your film. I'm looking forward to seeing it in the festival.
Thank you so much. And I'll also say that I think the real anxiety distributors have is that with the internet, the role of distributors is much, much smaller. They're still needed. They're still needed to provide certain services. But a lot of distributors believe that they're in the business of licensing, which they're not. They really don't need to be doing that now. And so in the arts, distributors, there's just like a lot less for them to do. We really don't need them to the extent that we needed them before the internet, now that the audience can actually share this work. And so it's understandable that they're concerned.
Are they blue?
They're blue. Poor distributors.
Are we blue? You'd be too. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. Nina, you graduated from University High School here on campus, and I teach there. I wasn't teaching when you were a student, but we have a lot of students who would love to meet you. Are you planning to drop by the school at all while you're in town?
I am. I'm going to drop by right after this interview.
Oh, wow. Where are you going?
Where am I going? I mean,
she's within walking distance.
I'm within walking distance. I walked right past uni on my way over, and I'm going to walk right past uni on my way back, and I'm going to bang on the door.
Right. Were you planning on meeting a particular class, though?
Nope. I was just going to surprise you, but now the cat's out of the bag.
Okay, fantastic. Well, congratulations on everything. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. What else are you doing in town?
Oh, golly. Well, I'm going to attend the entire film festival.
Great.
I love the way this festival is set up. I've never been to a festival like this, but they show each film once and everybody sees every film. So there's no schedule conflicts. I'm going to see all these films that have been at other festivals I've been at, but I've never been able to actually see them because there's all this other stuff going on.
Yeah. So are you going to visit any particular haunts that you, when you were growing up, when you were in high school, you want to go back and visit?
Well,
besides uni?
I have been stumbling around town. And of course, I had dinner with my parents last night and I'll see them again tonight. I hope to see my old friends in Urbana. We'll just see what
take it as it comes.
What the universe brings me here.
Nina Paley, our guest this afternoon. She is one of the filmmakers whose work will be featured during this 11th annual Roger Ebert's Film Festival, which opens today at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. Nina's film is Sita Sings the Blues, and it has won many awards and has won great critical acclaim, and she has a lot of fans out there thanks to it being available online. You can go and you don't have to drop into the festival. You don't have to have a ticket. You can see it online whenever you'd like. Her website, www.ninapaley.com. She's got a terrific blog as well.
There's actually another, you can see Sita Sings the Blues by going to sitasingstheblues.com.
Right.
And also, if you're interested in the copyright issues, please visit questioncopyright.org.
Okay. And listeners, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, join the conversation, give us a call. We got a couple minutes left. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, at the end of this letter to the audience, dear audience, you say, I've got to get back to my life now and make some new art. So what are you up to?
I still haven't made the new art, but I only wrote that a month ago, or I guess almost two months ago. Yeah. You know, my hands are totally full with this film still. When I wrote that, I thought, okay, it's just out of my hands now. I don't have to worry about it anymore. Well, all these people are like, we want to buy the DVD. We've got to buy a DVD. You got to sign it. You know, so I've been producing DVDs, one released by me, the artist edition, and the other released by questioncopyright.org. You know, I have to, there's all this stuff on the website I have to do, you know, my short films I need to put on archive.org. I'm still hoping to Creative Commons share alike license all my old comic strips. Again, mm-hmm. If anyone out there, any reliable volunteer out there wants to do that or a library or something. And once I get my life back, I'm hoping to do a series of short films about freedom of speech. We're calling them Minute Memes, and I'm going to be doing that in collaboration with questioncopyright.org. I have little songs about copyright. I can sing one of them.
Would you?
Yes.
Okay.
This one's online. It's called Copying Isn't Theft. Copying isn't theft. Stealing a thing leaves one less left. Copying it makes one thing more. That's what copying's for. Copying isn't theft. If I copy yours, you have it too. One for me and one for you. That's what copies can do. If I steal your bicycle, you have to take the bus. But if I just copy it, there's one for each of us. Making more of a thing. That is what we call copying. Sharing ideas with everyone. That's why copying is fun.
Let's take one more call before we're out of time.
Okay.
Champagne, line one. Hi.
That was a darling song.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it. And I am your neighbor from when you were a child on Oregon Street. I'm just calling to say congratulations.
Who is this?
It's Rana Gold.
Hello, Rana.
Hi, honey. How are you? and congratulations to your mom and dad and the whole family. You did great.
Well, thank you. They
Absolutely.
Did great.
And that's all I wanted to say.
Oh, well, thanks.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for the call.
What a nice note to end on.
Yeah, it's so great being from Urbana.
Yeah, well, it's good to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next time you're in town, come by.
Okay.
All right. Nina Paley, her film Sita Sings the Blues will be screened Saturday afternoon at 2:30 as part of the 11th annual Roger Ebert Film Festival, which opens today at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. Nina Paley, thank you so much.
Thank you.